Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hi, I'm actor and comedian Griffin Newman.
And I'm film critic David Sims.
Together, we host Blank Check, a movie podcast where week by week we overanalyze directors' complete filmographies.
In each new series, we discuss filmmakers who experience early success and are issued a series of blank checks by Hollywood to make their own crazy passion projects.
Now, sometimes those checks clear and sometimes they bounce, baby.
We're joined each week by incredible guests, including actors, writers, and directors. So you can follow Blank Check with Griffin and David on Spotify for new episodes every Sunday.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to
Unspooled.
I am Paul Scheer.
I'm Amy Nicholson.
And this is a very special episode. We are going to be sitting down today with Mark Harris. And Mark Harris, if you don't know, is an author and really an amazing biographer. I mean, Amy, like, he has written some like really classic books that talk a lot about things that we're talking about on the show all the time.
Oh, I mean, I feel like he's always coming up, from Pictures at a Revolution to 5K and back. Like, he does great work in film scholarship. And his new book is so perfect to talk about the show. It's a really in-depth biography of Mike Nichols, a director we've talked a lot about here. Of course, he directed The Graduate. He directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. His influence and the people he met extends through so many films that we have talked about on this show. I mean, even from the fact that I learned reading this book that when he was prepping to do Virginia Woolf, his very first film, he was watching 400 Blows over and over again, because he was like, this is a film made by a first-time director. I'm a first-time director, psyching himself up. So I think Mark is somebody we have to talk about, because I want to talk about Mike with the guy who is the number one Mike expert.
I remember, you know, when I started reading this book, just because I'm a fan of Mike Nichols, the thing that got me very much in the beginning was how he said his favorite movie and his guiding light for every film is A Place in the Sun, which we just spoke about. And it's interesting to think about that film and really about love and the connections and the small intimate moments. And you could really see, while, you know, his work is very different, it does exist in this idea of like wanting to be somebody else, wanting to, you know, want to doing things for love, doing things, you know, making bad choices. It really was fascinating to just have seen that film and then see how that affects all of his work. So if you're a fan of this show, I think you definitely will love this book. But if you need to have some convincing, I'm excited to introduce our guest today, which is Mark Harris. Please welcome Mark. So, Mark, I have to tell you, I love your book, and I feel like it is truly one of the best books I've read about acting and writing and directing. And I know it's not a book about acting, writing, and directing, but it's about this, you know, this man, Mike Nichols, who I don't think I fully understood his scope and his touch in the pop culture world that we live in. Like, he really has so many tentacles out there. How did you find out, like, you wanted to, like, go after him? Like, what was your entry point to him to know that this is a biography?
Well, thank you. I mean, I was interested in
Mike Nichols because I thought he had a really unique career. I mean, of course, being a theater director, being a movie director, sustaining both of those careers at the same time over 50 years and preceding both of those careers by a career as a performer, I thought just by the definition of his life, that would be an interesting thing to explore. But I actually, it sounds silly because he's a director, but I don't think I knew how much it was going to be a book about directing until I got really like deeply into the research. And then by extension, I didn't know how much writing a book about directing was also going to mean writing a book about acting and writing a book about writing. Like in retrospect, it seems, of course, I should have known that, but you know, it can always surprise you. And where you think you're going, where you start is not necessarily where you end up.
You know, I was going to say that I feel like the people that you spoke to really paint this picture in an interesting way. And they all bring to the table something small. Like, I feel like I was describing it to a friend and said, this is everyone who has been touched by Mike Nichols who had like one great thing. And they go, oh, you know what Mike Nichols told me? And you've collected all of those things. And it really paints this amazing picture of him in a way. But it is like, it's a set designer. It is an actor that may not be the most successful actor that we know, but was in a play with him. Or it was, you know, it's, you get this really full perspective. And I imagine even that going in through all that work, because there's so many actors, so many directors, so many people that you had to kind of go through. I mean, how do you even begin the research on a 50-year career?
I mean, I started, in terms of the interviews, by making a list of everyone who I could find, who I imagined sort of brushed up against him in any meaningful way at any point, who was still alive. And and it was probably between 500 and 600 people. And I ended up talking to, I would say, about 250 of them. But it is a strange thing because you have a list in your head of your big gets, the people you really, really want. And of course, some of them are on that list for a reason because you know they're going to give you great stuff. But I have found over the years, and I learned this on my first book a little bit, is the actor who doesn't have a very big part, or the editor, or the production designer, or the assistant, is often going to have stories that are at least as interesting and a perspective that's at least as interesting as the star. In a play, for instance, if someone has a small supporting part, they have a lot of time to watch how everything is unfolding, and they maybe had more time to observe things than a star would have. So whatever hierarchy I had imagined would exist kind of collapsed as soon as I started doing the interviews,
right,
with the exception of the fact that Elaine May was always at the very, very top of the list of people I felt I had to get. And in retrospect, that is exactly where she belonged.
Speaking of the scope and everybody he met over his lifetime, it really struck me because here on Unspooled, you know, of course, we talked about The Graduate. Of course, we talked about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And maybe we're going to get to talk about him a little bit more here. But I've always pictured Mike Nichols showing up in Hollywood as like this wunderkind, new voice, new generation entering. And yet you set the stage with him coming to Hollywood and being welcomed by like Wilder, Joseph Mankiewicz, Otto Preminger, people saying like, come into us, these old masters ushering him into Hollywood and giving him important advice.
I keep wondering if there is a parallel to now. I mean, I keep wondering whether a young director could emerge who would suddenly be welcomed by, you know, the whole roster of established A-list masters. And one reason the parallel is hard to find is nobody comes from theater anymore to suddenly emerge after directing just a handful of hit plays over a very short period of time and just rocket straight from there into, you know, a top tier movie assignment. It's just inconceivable now that someone who had never directed a movie would have been entrusted with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Like, you just, you don't get to come out of the gate doing that. And one thing I'm fascinated by about Nichols, and I stayed fascinated throughout the book, was he's sort of both things at once. Like, he is this Wunderkind can do no wrong, hit after hit after hit. Of course I can do this, boundlessly confident person who breezes into Hollywood at the age of 34, ready to direct Virginia Woolf. And he's also this guy who is a complete outsider, who has no Hollywood experience, who literally has to go to his friend Anthony Perkins and say, what are lenses? How does a camera work? You know, how can I show two people coming through the door without the door hitting me in the face? Like, he's completely unschooled, but at the same time, he's really confident that he can learn quickly what he needs to learn.
I would argue that he walks this tightrope his entire career, where there's a little bit of like a self-sabotage element to it. Can I pull it off? Can I do this thing? And you know, it's when he's first taking these acting classes, he's almost on the outside of it. And then he kind of finds something and it clicks, and it's with Elaine May, and it fires. And then all of a sudden it just kind of takes off. And I feel like this entire book, I don't know if it's also his depression that I think is a part of who he is, but his career is so interesting because you see him prepare for Virginia Woolf in a way that everything is thought out, the same way with The Graduate. And then you see him approach other things kind of carefree and kind of like, let me just pull it off. Let me see if I can pull it off. And like, oh, that didn't work. And then we repeat that cycle where prepare. And then we'll see. Like, I feel like he really walked this weird tightrope in his career of how he approached work.
I think it's true. I mean, I don't think he was trying to get away with anything, but I think he had a really strong case of imposter syndrome, you know, that fought within him against his natural confidence, because he really was at the same time the guy who walked into his first rehearsal room on his first day working on Barefoot in the Park, which was headed to Broadway, and says, and I believe this, that he instantly knew that this was his job, that what he was supposed to be was a director. But at the same time, there's this kind of constant terror of, can I pull this off? Am I going to get away with it? I mean, he says at one point that being a director is kind of a process of accepting failure every day, of finishing every day feeling that you're completely doomed, and thinking that maybe if everything goes right, you can pull yourself out of the fire the next day. I think he really felt that pretty much through his career.
Which is, you know, just as I'm an improviser, and that's how I came up. That's what improv is, right? You get on stage and you don't have a script, and you're kind of finding this, you know, you're trying to act real. And sometimes it's the most beautiful thing. And sometimes you just eat shit. I mean, and that's okay. And that's part of the, I mean, it's stand-ups too. It's like, and I think there is that performer element of, let me just try it. It's so bizarre to me, because I think I was getting frustrated in the book. Sometimes like, wait, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you do that? Why? Like, you know, like, I wanted to see him just click over. And I was so amazed at the detail and care he could take with something like Closer at the very end of his career. But then you juxtapose that with like, What Planet Are You From? The Gary Shandling one, which seemed like, oh, it's like this weird money job and all the turmoil that went there. And I feel like it was really hard for me to kind of put that together. Like, oh, how he could be, he was still with it, I guess, is what I'm saying, at the end of his career. Like, he knew how to do both versions of it.
One thing that really struck me, this was from both talking to Elaine May about their work together and from talking to Mike over the years, was how incredibly vivid and like emotionally vivid the stories of his failures, of their failures at improv were. Like, The stories about the really famous sketches were really fun, and he told them a dozen times. But the stories about when he flopped, or when she flopped, or when they flopped together, I mean, Elaine May told me one. It's in the book about them getting on stage and realizing they it's a phone call situation, and they had come up with a situation that they realized too late allowed for neither of them to say a word.
Right.
and just like they both died in slow motion on stage, and there was no way to get out of it. When she was telling me about that, she made it sound as if it had happened like yesterday. The feelings were that vivid. She almost shuddered talking about it. And I think in some ways, the thing that Mike got out of that was, it doesn't kill you. Like, you fall hard on your face, but you live to get on stage the next day. You survive, and maybe you even learn what you did wrong. And that was a really important part of Elaine's story, that she said they figured out from that sketch bombing what they had done wrong and what they should never do again. And I think Mike's whole career, in a way, is, I mean, we tend to define directorial careers by the successes, but Mike's career is also defined by how he learned to come back from his own failures, how he learned to, like, incorporate a failure and figure out what to take from it and what the next thing that he should do was, which I found a really inspiring part of his story.
I'm paraphrasing you, which may be paraphrasing Mike, which is, like, after a failure, you must follow it up with something extremely personal and small. And that idea is such a beautiful idea, because I think it's always like getting back to the root of why you're doing it. Like, what is something that makes you passionate about this business or whatever? And the choices that he makes after the failures, it's really eye-opening, like what he chooses to do, whether or not that's starring in Virginia Woolf at one point, or, you know, going back and taking this, like, that Wallace Shawn play and doing, like, things like that. You know, it's like, it's...
I mean, if you could do a festival of Mike's post-failure choices, and it would include acting in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on stage, David Rabe's play Streamers, which many people said was the best thing he ever did on stage, Carnal Knowledge, Wit for HBO. I mean, you could ask, I guess, well, if he was so good at figuring out what to do after a failure, why wasn't he better at figuring out how to avoid the failure
in the
first place? But, you know, that was in some ways a bigger challenge for him. One thing I loved about the rhythm of his career was he's this roaring success as a performer with Elaine May. Then he does four straight New York stage hits in a row. Then he does Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate back to back. But then after that, for the next, you know, 45 years of his life, he has a more normal rhythm of there are successes, there are failures, there are big hits, there are things that do okay, there are nice comeback successes, there are big flops. So, you know, part of his story to me is like the story of growing up from the guy with the Midas touch who, you know, can't do anything wrong and hasn't even hit 40 yet, to someone who's in it for the long haul and is going to have to work with his own limitations and discover what he really loves and cares about and why he wants to direct, not just figuring out how to amass successes in the world, but what does directing mean to him?
Right, which is its own, I think, kind of deeper inspirational part of this book, you know? Because it's hard to imagine any of us being born with like that Midas touch that he has, but to be able to keep doing the work every day. And what really struck me in this reading is, as he's climbing up in the world, as he's making that ascent, I didn't realize what an integral part Elizabeth Taylor was just in all of that. You know, how much the movie A Place in the Sun mattered to him, how much meeting her years before they did Virginia Woolf together affected him, that she introduced him to the person who made him better toupees. I didn't know that he was bald his whole life, also,
oh
by the
gosh.
Way.
Oh, my gosh.
So, like, the idea that he went through his life from a child being very insecure about never having hair because of a childhood vaccine, and Elizabeth Taylor helps him have good hair. I was really hard not to get into, like, cheap psychology. What did that mean to him? How does that shape you as a person?
I got to say, and Mark, I looked at so many pictures after this and before. Like, I know he talks and obviously felt that he had terrible wigs. I mean, maybe I'm bad at seeing it, but like I was looking at the early versions, pictures of Mike Nichols, and I was like, this doesn't look that bad. Like, it doesn't look that bad, right? You know, but yeah.
All 50s hair looks kind of glued on, doesn't it? All of it anyway, so...
It's true. And then, you know, by the time he got certainly to Broadway, they were really, really good. But yeah, it is a fascinating part of his story. I mean, especially because he was so composed, he was so polished, his self-presentation was so kind of elegant and practiced that it's jolting to realize that it looked practiced because it was practiced. He had to, like, turn himself into himself every day.
That line stuck out to me more than any line in the book, which was, it takes me 3 hours to become Mike Nichols. And whether or not that is how that translated later on in his life, but that idea of like, here is somebody, the book talks a lot about how he would stay in bed through college and like his depression sometimes would be just like, he'd be in bed. And I was like, oh my God, I would probably stay in bed too if I knew like, you just can't get out of bed. You got to get out of bed and you got to put on that wig and you got to put on those eyebrows. And it's such a weight upon a depression to then also have to put your face on. I couldn't help but think about how that would affect him.
I mean, once he talked about just being exhausted from what he called the sheer effort of being a person that many hours a day. And that sounds like, in one way, classic depression talking. But in another way, like, there's a very specific way in which it was an effort for him to be a person. Like, as you said, it's not just getting out of bed. It's getting out of bed and kind of putting your head on. That's again, when I think of contemporary directors, because I think in some ways Mike Nichols is not, and maybe Amy can talk about this, but like, I think he's not a fashionable director in a way. He doesn't fit the model of what we now tend to look for in directors, which is mostly people who write their own scripts and who have a very specific kind of vision of the world or of America or of their art that they're going to kind of self-curate over several movies. Mike Nichols was not like that. The special things, I think, about his direction were largely collaborative. It was what he could elicit from a writer, in particular what he could elicit from actors. You know, the way a particular moment in a performance could be shaped. That's not stuff that we tend to really revere in directors these days, partly because if a director does it well, it is made to look like it's somebody else's achievement, which is part of the point of directing, I think.
I mean,
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we have been talking about that, I think, even more and more on this show. We just recently did an episode on Reiner, you know, Rob Reiner, and like his string of 80s hits and how amazing they are. And like, I like poking holes in the idea of only the damaged, troubled auteur, you know, like that's the artist, and people who are brilliant and collaborative aren't. And I hate that type of thinking, so I love going on the attack against it.
Well, I saw, I think it was maybe an Onion story or an Onion headline recently that said something like, wealthy, introverted brothers in gated suburban community are under intense pressure to become indie filmmakers. That isn't Mike's story, but it is that's a story we're really familiar with telling, but it's not the only story of how to be a director.
It's funny that kind of cliche then are the people who like get to tell the personal stories, the story that's already such a cliche. We're like, we must have this person who lives this micromanaged airless life to tell the story of his airless life over and over again, and his clone and his other clone.
I think there's something really interesting though. Like, I think at the end of the day, a lot of times we judge directors by how interesting is the shot, how, you know, composed is this, and really the best directors, you talk about the performances a lot more than you talk about, oh, who directed those performances. Like, wow, that was an amazing performance. And it's because that director gets them there. And I think that you do a beautiful job of showing how, whether it's like a door frame being too wide or too small or chairs in one spot, like Mike had this idea of like, he was really conducting an orchestra of artisans and going like, this is the right mix here. And when you read about his life, here's a man who is hanging out with Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Avedon, you know, in this circle of elite New York theater. But yet those are the stories that he really, like, he never got above that, I feel like, and in a great way. Like, he always stayed in the grounded personal space. It was always very small. Like, he didn't talk about being the super wealthy person or living in that world. Everything felt a lot smaller and grittier to me a little bit.
I think that's true. And I think it's partly because although he did absolutely live in that world and was in many ways at the center of it, there was always this other part of him that felt like it could go away, that he's only there because someone who really belongs in that world gave him a ticket into it, but that it could all erode instantly. Like when he has his nervous breakdown, which I write about in the 1980s, I think it's really telling that it manifests itself in a fear that he's going to lose everything, that he's going to be a pauper, that he's going to lose all his money. And the times that he makes bad decisions in his career, whether it's doing What Planet Are You From, or when he essentially prices himself out of this version of La Cage aux Folles that he really wants to direct on Broadway, often it's a money decision that sends him astray. But I also think that in a way that the upside of that paranoia, that constant concern, that insider outsider feeling, is that he didn't lose his really sharp ability to notice the little idiosyncratic pieces of behavior of people in that world. And maybe if he'd been completely in it and completely comfortable with it, that kind of stuff is what he would have stopped noticing. But he was just outside of it all enough to like be able to pick it out and help put it in a performance.
Yeah, I mean, walking through his whole life the way that we get to in this book, Working Girl feels even more of a miracle to me because I love that movie so much and he gets that movie and I feel like he understands Tess so clearly. And to put it, you know, decades into his career, how little I feel like he knew of a person like Tess he would have known at that time. You know, you talk about him like not believing that girls from the island actually did dress like that until like his costumers showed him pictures and like, no, really, this is what they look like. Like they're almost a different species of human. And yet I think that film has so much humanity. And it's such, what is that? Is he just such a great listener? What is happening? Like, how does he pull that off?
That movie is such a great example of how movies that people love are often this collection of accidents and coincidences and struggles that don't show. Because, you know, of course, there was terrible difficulty between him and Melanie Griffith. You know, that was a druggy time. And, you know, Melanie Griffith has talked, I think, since then about, you know, having a cocaine and alcohol problem while making the movie. And so it was not an easy relationship between them while they were shooting. And then also one thing I didn't know at all until I started doing interviews is that the producer of Working Girl told me that the first cut of the movie, which was about 15 or 20 minutes longer, did not work at all, was not getting laughs. The story didn't play. And he said that what they discovered was that Mike had left a little too much time at the beginning of every scene and a little too much time at the end of every scene, and that it was just enough time for audiences to say, this is bullshit. This would never happen this way. And as soon as they cut that out of every scene, the movie worked like a charm. And the same thing in some ways happened on Carnal Knowledge. Jules Pfeiffer said that the first cut of that movie, he told Nichols, oh, you're trying to be too Bergman-esque. It's slow. It's ponderous. It's too self-important. And Nichols solved it with his editor by just trimming the beginning and the end of each scene. And then, you know, it took him 4 days. And he went from that version to the final cut of Carnal Knowledge. So I don't know. It's there's something in there about giving people too much.
Well, you were saying too, and this is, I think, a rule for comedy in general and you know, just being tight on your edits. And Mike got to the point, I think maybe after Carnal Knowledge, where he would sometimes cut too much because he was like, oh, like get rid of it. Like he wanted, like anything that didn't work was like jettisoned. And sometimes maybe for better or for worse, probably the better version is what you're saying in Working Girl, which is like trims, not full extractions.
Right, right. But I'm interested, like, I wonder if this resonated for you at all, because one thing that I heard over and over again was that Mike was, like, very open and exploratory about drama and was really willing to, like, kind of be open-ended with an actor and help them find their way. But with comedy, like, he would lay down the law. Like, if he saw someone chasing a laugh or pandering or mugging to the audience or falling too much in love with a bit and holding on to it in performance after performance, he was ruthless about saying, that's phony, it's not human, you're undercutting the whole enterprise. He was tough on people with comedy.
Well, I think it all stems from, at least the way that I came up in the improv world, was this thing that came out of I.O. And Second City to a certain extent, which is like playing it real, like play the scene like it's a drama, you know, react the way that you would react. Don't make every character with like a limp and a wig. You know, it's like you just play it real. And that was something always ingrained. And when I read this, I was like, oh, yeah, it makes sense, because he's probably working with a lot of people whose backgrounds aren't comedy, you know, and sometimes he is working with, but you can play too much into it. One of the things I'm fascinated by, I wondered if you actually got to see it, was, did you ever see the full rules of comedy from Spamalot that he kept backstage?
I did.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It's not super long or anything. It's right. It's maybe about double the length of what I put in the book, but okay. It's pretty great, you know, and in those rules, and I think they're literally called rules, like you can feel the tough part of him. And with Spamalot was a thing where I got to talk to a lot of the actors involved. I mean, Hank Azaria, Christian Borle, David Hyde Pierce, people who are really good at comedy and really good at improv. And they all said the same thing, which is that they thought it was so silly when Mike would say to them, we have to tell a story. We are telling a story. It can't just be this loose, disconnected series of sketches. Even if the story is incredibly thin and silly, we have to tell the story like we believe in it. And they all said, you know, in once they got into performance and once Mike started making cuts in the show to that end, he was exactly right. And that's what made the show work.
What is your favorite movie that he did? Do you like, you know, maybe, or one that, you know, obviously there are the staples, but is there one that you maybe came to appreciate more in working on this, or did it always stay the same for you?
My favorite, it's a really boring answer because I've spent so many years now with The Graduate and I've seen it so many times that I feel like it's part of my DNA. But I have to say, like, in rewatching everything over and over and over again for this book, I really kind of fell in love with Heartburn in a way that I did not expect to. I liked it. I saw it when it came out, but I wouldn't say that I had a particularly strong memory of it. And rewatching it for this and then reporting about it and writing about it, you could just see so many of his strengths as a director, all that really acute social observation, that particular understanding of a class, that great knack for getting performances out of everyone, his complete comfort with working in a world of women. I mean, Heartburn is written by a woman. It centers Meryl Streep. It's got all kinds of other great actresses in it. You know, like Catherine O'Hara shows up. I think that movie has a ton of his strengths, and it's so interesting to me that it was just brushed aside by critics when it opened, by almost entirely male critics. That was a real sort of lesson and turning point for me in working on the book to realize what kind of work is valued and what kind of work is not.
Very much. I'm glad you brought that up. We were actually just referring to that the other day because we did an episode on When Harry Met Sally. And so that's a film we should dig out sometime, Paul. What do you think?
Well, the first movie I watched when I finished your book, Mark, was Heartburn. Because I was like, this was a movie that was in my house growing up. My mom watched Heartburn a million times. And when you made this reference that it wasn't well received, I was like, well, no, that's a hit. That's a huge hit, that movie. I know that's a hit. Just because it was a part of my childhood in the background. And wow, I went back and watched it. And I was like, this movie is great. And I feel it in a weird way. It was like a couple years earlier than Working Girl. Like, I feel like if it came out, like when Working Girl came out, it would have maybe hit that same, you know, ramp in a way. Cause it's a solid movie. It's really, really good.
Yeah. I think it got caught in this weird thresher of everyone deciding that this was going to be their opportunity to say something about the Carl Bernstein, Nora Ephron marriage and about the propriety of that novel. And it really just got, punished in some ways. I think you're exactly right by its release date. If there'd been a little more distance between the actual divorce and the novel and the movie, maybe people would have been better about it.
And you are exactly right. I mean, I feel like we still have that problem today with romantic comedies. Even being a female critic, even knowing that this happens, even getting mad when I see it happen, I think there is a tendency to like take half a letter grade off for some reason. You're like, it's just fluffy though. I don't want to give it an A plus. I'll give it a B plus. Like it doesn't mean anything. And every time there's a few movies in my own past, I know I like took half a letter grade off and then rewatched them. I'm like, you're such an idiot. You told yourself not to do that. And then you did it again. I think there's something with a romantic film where if you get misty, you feel like the film tricked you and you're mad. You're like, I'm too smart to fall for your tricks.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's this weird thing of like all successful movies make you feel something, but certain feelings make you feel more manipulated, I guess, than other feelings. And romantic comedies is one of them, I suppose. But so that was a really happy discovery for me. I'd seen all of Mike's movies, I think, before I started working on the book. And some of them, you know, you go into certain movies and you think, oh, maybe this will be my chance to really redeem this movie. And you see the movie and you're like, no, that's pretty bad. it just doesn't work, does it? But that one was a happy one for me.
I really want to find now the television version of the British play that he did. That is a Wallace Shawn run, right? The where they taped it for TV and he was angry.
The Designated Mourner, yeah.
Yes.
If you like do a little sort of comb through streaming services and maybe like check out Vimeo and like you can find it.
Okay.
It's pretty amazing because he comes up with a really distinctive way of delivering his lines, which I mean, there's no other way to describe it. He constantly sounds like he's about to burp or he's having heartburn or something. It's this very eruptive kind of speech, but also he sounds so much like he sounded in conversation that it's like just a great chance to kind of listen to Mike at his most seductive and appealing. Wow. And then you realize that he's playing this monster, this moral monster, and he totally uses it. He knows exactly what he's doing. It's a great performance.
Now, Mark, this has been a lovely conversation, so I don't want to start a fight. I don't want to start any sort of a fight. I will say up front, I am the person who doesn't like The Graduate for certain editing. Actually, what we're talking about, I think, is so interesting. I think if he had edited a little bit of the comedy out of that movie, I might have liked it more. But you thread such an interesting needle when you're talking about him making that film, because you talk about how much he felt like he identified with Benjamin and how that was turning him into pretty much an asshole. Like, you're not shy about saying what a horrible person he was to be around on that set, because there's something in that character and this relationship that felt really vulnerable to him. And then you make this connection that had never occurred to me. This idea of like his proxy, Benjamin, at the end of the movie yelling Elaine over and over again, this like name of this woman who was such a figure in his life, in his own life.
I'm embarrassed to tell you that I wrote an entire book about The Graduate. And that did not occur to me until I was doing this one. I mean, I could not believe it when it was sitting right in front of my face. And I ran back to the novel because I thought, oh, my God, if this character isn't named Elaine, then I've really discovered something. But the character is named Elaine. On the other hand, he chose the novel. So, you know, make of that what you will. It's there. This is such a hard thing for me to write about, and it's something that really creative people do that I cannot pretend to understand, which is that he followed his subconscious. Like, he knew there was something in the story of Benjamin that he wanted to tell, and he knew that the way Benjamin was described as looking in the novel, which was very much like Robert Redford or, you know, some blonde... I mean, he goes and fights forest fires in the novel.
Oh, wow.
He knew that that wasn't what he wanted, and he had such a strong vision for it that he was willing to cast a complete unknown, Dustin Hoffman, but he didn't know why he felt that way by his own description until years after making the movie. And that kind of, like, I wonder about myself in those terms as a writer, and I wonder it about all creative people. Like, how do you teach yourself to listen to something that you can't hear inside yourself? Just some instinct that tells you, yeah, go toward this. It's okay that you don't know why. It's enough that you just know that you want to go toward this. You'll figure out why later.
Yeah.
That makes me think of meditation, or like Lynch and TM and everything.
Well, this has been amazing to chat with you. I recommend everyone to get this book because, again, I don't think that you understand I was a Mike Nichols fan. I did not understand the tentacles that he weaved through actors, writers, popular entertainment, especially if you're a fan of our show, Unspooled. We've talked about so many things that are a part of this book. And I will say, and I may have written this in the tweet that I sent out too, the end of the book made me cry. I felt like I was at his memorial service. And it was the journey that you took me on there. It was like, I'm in my kitchen finishing reading. I'm like, and there's a tear coming down my face. I'm like, oh, but you've really done this job of making the reader feel like a passenger in this man's life. And you were there, and it really was a beautiful ending. And the last week of his life leading up to that service at the IAC building or whatever that is. And it really got me.
Oh, well, thank you so much. The end of the book made me cry too. And it's not because like, oh, look at my beautiful writing. I'm crying because I'm so good. It was just because after all these years of working on the book and thinking about him, I had to let go of him again. And I found that really tough.
Well, Amy, I couldn't have been more happy to talk to Mark about all of this. It makes me even more excited just to tell people to pick up this book.
Me too. There's like a gazillion other anecdotes I wanted to ask him about, but we would be here all day. So just read the book and you will also know the gazillion other anecdotes, and you'll know like, Amy, why didn't you ask him about the time that Taylor got the assistant director fired on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Be like, I wanted to ask Mark about everything.
Or when they fired Robert De Niro from a Neil Simon movie 2 days into production and then they shut down the movie. Literally, he was the star of a Neil Simon film. They killed the whole movie.
He studied under Strasberg. He studied under Strasberg right when everybody else was being famous. Oh, there's so much I want to talk to him about.
So much to talk about. Well, get the book and it will do you right. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Bye for now.